sit and close her eyes and use her imagination. A comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show. Radio, oh, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you so.
Once again, it's time for Yesteryear. A look back at your favorite dramas, westerns, comedies, and musical variety shows from the golden age of radio. Here's your host for Yesteryear, Craig Roberts.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, and as always, welcome again to Yesteryear, the best of the golden age of radio. On today's program, a couple of special treats. We have unearthed a very rare recording of Vincent Price in a program entitled An Eye for an Eye. We'll get to Vincent Price and that mystery program coming up in the second half of today's edition of Yesteryear. But first, one of our legends of comedy, none other than Bob Hope. Bob Hope is arguably the most popular entertainer in the history of the world, if at least not in radio. His radio program first began in the late 1930s after his appearance in a feature film debut entitled The Big Broadcast of 1938, where, of course, he sang his now famous theme song, Thanks for the Memory. The Bob Hope Show aired on NBC from November 1938 through April of 1955. Today's edition of The Bob Hope Show was taken from April of 1941. Bob jokes about spring cleaning, and Hedda Hopper visits Hope's dress and hat shop. Here then, from April 15th of 1941, is The Bob Hope Show with special guest star columnist Hedda Hopper on this edition of Yesteryear.
Major Bo. I miss the shadow nose, Fred Allen's alley folks, the laughter of Duffy's Tavern, Helen Trent. Oh, then we went to Can You Top This? Suspense in the Whistler sent those shivers up our spines. Uncle Don, I wish that he was on. Jack Armstrong, Bert and Marge, Amos and
ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Spring Cleaning Hope telling you to use Pepsodent, and while you're making your house spick and span, you won't hear a bridge click in your pan. Is that a wonderful joke? What a joke. I told that joke to Jimmy Roosevelt last week. Now he has to have a nurse steady. Well, this is the time of the year we all start our own spring cleaning now that Morgenthau's through with us. But you should see me doing my spring house cleaning this week. We sure worked hard cleaning the living room. First I rolled the rug back, then I mowed the grass. Found another rug. All year long, you know. All year long we kept sweeping the dirt under the living room rug. In fact, the rug was so high, to get on it you had to be the thief of Baghdad. I saw the picture. Yes, sir. Where were you? But I want to tell you, at our house, the dust was so thick I had to probe for the furniture. There was so much dust around the house, the termites were running around yelling Gesundheit to each other. And our oriental rug needed cleaning. In fact, the gopher had been living in it so long, he had slanted eyes. But we're not worried about the rugs much because we have a good vacuum cleaner, that Santa need on a stick. But we did clean. Today, first thing in the morning, I decided to go up and clean the attic. When I got up there, I came across a bunch of old Esquires in one corner. Tomorrow, first thing in the morning, I'm going to clean the attic. But I really know how to clean house. I took the Venetian blinds down and put them in the electric washer and turned on the switch. Anybody want to buy 38,000 toothpicks? And I hadn't changed the water in the goldfish bowl for 2 years, so I put some clean, fresh water in it. The goldfish swam to the top, took a breath of fresh air, and said, "Gosh, that was a long blackout." And I got a few surprises, too. I opened one closet door, and I saw a man with a long white beard. I said, "What are you doing in there?" He said, "I'm the exterminator." He pointed to a horse in one corner and said, "I came in here 20 years ago to kill that mouse." Nice joke. I know, I rolled that joke on the White House lawn yesterday. I did, yes, I did. But my house is really clean now. My paint started to fade a little, so I repainted the house with Pepsodent. Now I've got the only house in America whose bay window smiles at you. May not be funny, but it's a plug. I got you there. But everybody's cleaning, no kidding. One workman spent 2 days cleaning the windows of Hedy Lamarr's house until she told me she'd call the police. And I had an accident while I was cleaning my house. I poured some glue on the piano stool by mistake. My uncle sat down on it yesterday. So far, he's played I Hear a Rhapsody 3,000 times.
Say, Bob, there's something I'd like to speak to you about.
Why, certainly, William. What is it?
Well, you know, Bob, I've been on your radio program for 3 years now. And in all that time, we've never had a fight about money.
That's right, Bill.
In fact, you've never even mentioned it.
Wait a minute, William. I don't want you giving the audience the impression that I'm cheap. Just to assure you that my heart's in the right place, take this $1,000 bill.
Oh, gee, thanks, Bob.
And here's another $1,000 bill.
Thanks.
And another $1,000 bill.
Thanks. Boy, will you be in a spot when television comes in.
In a town in Sweden, by a stream so clear and cool, a boy would sit and fish and dream when he should have been in school. He couldn't read or write a word, but happiness he found.
In a little song he heard,
here's how it would sound.
Hutt-set rolls-in on the reel-a-row and the roll-up, roll-a-sue-it. Hutt-set rolls-in on the reel-a-row and the roll-a-sue-it. Hutt-set rolls-in on the reel-a-row and the roll-up, roll-a-sue-it. Hutt-set rolls-in on the reel-a-row and the roll-a-sue-it.
Now the Ralston is a Swedish town, the reel-a-row is a stream. The brawler is the boy and girl,
but
that is their dream.
Hutt-set rolls on the reel-a-row and the brawler-sue-it. Hutt-set rolls on the reel-a-row and the brawler-sue-it.
We have heard that all the Swedish guys sing this song to all their sweetie pies.
That's a frog and on the river and the frog and roll and do it. That's a frog and on the river and the frog and do it. That's a frog.
Was our six hits and a miss in the orchestra and Hutt-Set song. The six hits and a miss are now six hits and a misses. Mm. In a little while, this program will have six hits and misses and a few quiz kids. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Pauline and Jerry did it. Las Vegas. Where are we? Let's get into it. And now it is my pleasure to present one of Hollywood's best-known personalities, screen actress, newspaper columnist, radio commentator, and wearer of Hollywood's dizziest hats, Miss Hedda Hopper, ladies and gentlemen.
Ahead. Thank you, Bob. I love that introduction, wearer of Hollywood's dizziest hats. Of course, my hat is a little tricky, isn't it?
I'll say. I could hardly wait for 7 o'clock to see the cuckoo come out.
Why, Bob, it's my new Easter bonnet.
Really? Does that thing lay an egg, Hubby? I wish you wouldn't bring that competition around. Did you see me? Oh, it's all right. Oh, just let them... Did you see me in the... Did you see me in the Easter parade Sunday morning, Hedda?
Yes, and I really don't think you know how to dress, Bob.
Don't know how... Why? Didn't I look formal?
Well, for one thing, you're not supposed to wear a top hat with bare feet.
Since when? I mean, Oh, it clashes, eh? Well, if you'd taken a good look at me, Hedda, you'd have seen I was wearing top hat, cutaway coat, and striped pants.
Striped pants? Yeah, that was a good idea, drawing black lines in your long underwear.
Why, Hedda, I thought my outfit was a real production. I gave a lot of thought and study to it.
Yes, it was an elaborate suit, Bob, but didn't you overdo it a little bit?
Overdo it?
I mean, having that midget trot along behind you carrying the extra pair of pants.
Well, I gave that midget those pants. He cuts the pockets out and uses them for pillowcases. Hedda, I suppose... That's a long line for nothing. I suppose... What am I doing in there? Hedda, I suppose you spent a whole week figuring out your Easter outfit.
Well, not exactly, Bob. I was busy with my own radio program.
Oh, yes. Hedda Hopper's Hollywood.
Yes, I broadcast for Sunkissed Oranges and Lemons.
Well, I broadcast for Pepsodent and Toothpaste.
You know, Bob, we're nothing but a couple of squirts.
Yeah, well... Look, I wonder if Pepsodent toothpaste and Sun-Kissed oranges have anything in common.
Well, sure they have. To get the best out of them, you have to squeeze them both.
I know a couple of girls like that. Look, I suppose you want to put in a plug for your product, Hedda.
No, Bob, I only want to tell the folks how marvelous Sun-Kissed oranges are. They're luscious, juicy, big, delectable, and the best California can grow.
All finished?
Yes.
Okay, Florida, tune back in. Are we bragging as though they were ever in? Isn't that marvelous?
Say, Bob, what do you do when you're not busy with radio and pictures?
Well, I like to take a trip to Catalina, lie out on the beach, and admire the pretty girls in their bathing suits.
And Edward G. Robinson thinks he's the sea wolf. And while we're on the subject, I've heard a lot about you and Bill Goodwin standing on the corner of Vine Street.
You hear that, Bill?
Yes, I did, Bob.
And let me tell you something. Only kids would stand on corners and whistle at girls. Only kids would try to flirt with girls. And only kids would try to kiss girls.
Well, meet the men of Boys Town.
That did it, William. That did it.
Well, if you boys can't get girls, before I was a Hollywood columnist, I was an advice to the Lovelorn editor. Maybe I can give you some advice.
No, that wouldn't help, Hedda. I once went to a Lovelorn editor. That was quite a while ago when I was still a shy and bashful boy before I started to use Pepsodent.
Pepsodent. Pepsodent, Pepsodent. All that ever comes out of you is Pepsodent.
Well, shoot the stopper to me, Hopper.
What did you go to see the Lovelorn editor about, Bob? I suppose it was your first love affair.
Yes, it was a sensational affair, Hedda. She was 16 and I was 18.
What made you fall in love with her?
Oh, I guess it was the way she handled a pool cue. No, but we came to the parting of the ways.
What broke up your romance?
Well, her mother didn't like me. She used to see me hanging around the runway in burlesque theaters. It made her nervous when she was dancing. So the next day, there I was, Hedda, at the door of the Advice to the Lovelorn editor.
Come in.
Say, is this the Advice to the Lovelorn?
Goodbye, Miss Hopper.
Goodbye, Mr. Battleball.
This is it. Say, are you to the Advice to the Lovelorn editor?
Why, yes. Here, let me take your hat and turtle.
Oh, thanks.
You're a country boy, aren't you?
Yes, I'm from the country. How'd you know?
Well, never mind. I'll open the window. You're about the most bashful boy I've ever seen. Say, do you always suck your thumb?
Yep, can't quite reach my big toe anymore.
Well, tell me, what's your problem?
Well, I broke up with my girl, Lulabell. I ain't been able to sleep ever since. I'm always thinking about her.
Well, perhaps I can help you. Why don't you describe Lulabell to me?
Well, her face ain't much to look at, but her figure, gee, it's awful. We used to have a lot of fun together, but then I began to suspect she was going with another fella.
Well, what made you think that?
Well, every time I walk into the parlor, she's sitting there necking with him. Gee, I don't understand it. I don't understand why Lulabell don't love me.
Well, perhaps her family objected. What do her folks think of you?
Well, her mother's away in an army camp.
Her mother's in an army camp?
Yeah, she always insisted on wearing the pants in the family, and this time she got drafted.
Well, perhaps you're not romantic enough. Tell me, when the lights are low and there's soft music playing and you two are all alone in the room and all is still, what do you do?
I eat peanuts.
Why?
Well, I ain't the type to sit around and do nothing.
Wait. When did you realize that Lulu Bell was beginning to slip away from you?
Oh, just the other day. I was holding her in my arms, looking tenderly into her eyes, and then she puckered up her little lips.
Yes, yes?
What a time to blow a spitball.
Well, don't worry about her. You can get plenty of girls. You know, you're kind of cute. Here, let me fix your necktie for you.
Oh, gee, we're standing this close to a woman. It gives me goose pimples all over.
On you, it's an improvement. Oh, I sure
must. You got some of that fuzz on your tongue there, you know. That dropped down from that hat. Where are we?
You'd think it was a bird's nest.
Can I send that on the road? Well, go ahead.
Come on, handsome. Sit down here beside me.
Oh, gosh. Do you think it's safe?
Well, certainly. I won't bite you.
Go ahead. I like it.
Now, let me give you a few pointers. Next time you hold Lulu Bell in your arms, run your fingers through her hair like I'm running mine through yours.
Oh, shucks. Don't run your fingers through my hair. It keeps reminding me of something.
Well, what's that?
I got to do my spring plowing.
Oh, come on. How about a kiss?
A kiss? What's that?
Don't you know what a kiss is? Well, what does your mother do when your father comes from work and she sees him?
Oh, slugging.
Oh, no. I'll show you what a kiss is. There. How did you like that?
Did we get across Sunset Boulevard all right? Thank you, Hedda Hopper. Hedda will be back with us in a few minutes, folks. Take it.
For sentimental me, for romantic you, dreaming dreams is all that we can do. We hang around all day and ponder, while both of us grow fonder. The Lord knows where we're wandering to. I sit and sigh, you sigh and sit upon my knee. We laugh and cry and never disagree. A million kisses we'll make theft of, until there's nothing left of poor romantic you and sentimental me. You sigh and sit upon my knee. We laugh and cry and never disagree. A million kisses we'll make theft of, until there's nothing left of poor romantic you and sentimental me.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear.
Lazy little Daisy at the gate beside a garden wall. Wake up.
And now Bob Hope presents his version of Lazy Little Daisy. As our scene opens, we find Bob and yours truly running the new Bob Hope Ladies Dress and Hat Shoppy.
Oh, say, Bill.
Yes, Bob.
Well, here I am running my own women's dress shop. This will show Paramount I can handle the skirts.
You know, Bob, this store is all right, but you ought to get some more dresses made out of tweed.
Made out of what?
Tweed. Tweed. Tweed.
How are you in wild animal calls? I'd like to call my agent. Where are we?
Hey! What's that going by the front door so fast?
That's Mrs. Roosevelt going to Jimmy's wedding. She's back already.
Hey, Bob, you know the wax dummy in front of the store? Well, Hedy Lamarr just walked by it.
Hedy Lamarr just walked by the wax dummy?
Yeah.
Well, what do you know? Candles. Say, I meant to ask you, Bill, what about the hats I designed this morning? How are they selling?
Oh, fine, Bob. This afternoon, Humphrey Bogart got his first look at the hat we made for his wife.
I wonder how long he'll stay up in the hills this time. Hello, Hope's Dress and Hat Shop, Hollywood Patterns exclusively.
Hello, Chief. This is your assistant, Professor Colonna. Expert buyer, salesman, designer and cutter, also telephone slugs, 3 for a nickel.
Never mind that, Professor. Are you selling any dresses?
Yes, boss. I'm now measuring Venus de Milo for a dress.
Venus de Milo?
Yes. How can her old man let her run around like that? Now, stand still a minute, Venus, while I take your measurements. Length, 52. Waist, 18. Arms. Come, get them out of your pockets, kid.
Don't you know Venus has no arms?
No arms? Very interesting. Very interesting. Come here, Veen.
Oh, get that.
We learn something new every day, don't we?
Say, Bob, excuse me, but that construction company called before, and they said that their order was a mistake. They wanted to buy some girders, not girdles.
Well, gosh, Bill, how did they find out their mistake?
Well, every time the wind blows, the 10th story does a two-way stretch. You know, Bob, I've been thinking. We should have a big sale.
All right, hand me the matches. Howard, hand them to me.
Not again. We're still smoking from yesterday. Well, I meant to tell you, Bob, the truck just brought in a new shipment of lingerie, and there seems to be a piece missing.
One piece missing? How could that be?
Well, I don't know, but that's the first time I ever saw a truck driver wearing lace panties.
Bill, those weren't lace panties. The union makes them sit on a doily. Hello?
Hello, Hope. This is Colonna, the big buyer, seller, exchanger. Also, room for rent in the rear. No children. Now, listen, boss. I'm down here at the silk factory getting some silk. Tell me, Hope, when silkworms spin a cocoon, they're supposed to spin it around themselves, aren't they?
That's right. Silkworms always spin their cocoons around themselves.
See, fellas? Now, let me out of here.
Professor Colonna, you can't make me believe you're in a cocoon. I just saw you going out to the park.
That's right, Hope. I'm out here at the park getting some furs. There's a little animal running around in the bushes.
Well, grab it, Colonna. It's a chipmunk.
Oh, no, Hope. I think it's a skunk.
No, it isn't. Grab it. It's a chipmunk.
Okay. Here, pussy. Wow!
What's the matter, Colonna?
If that's a chipmunk, it's got a wonderful defense program.
Colonna, this is the last straw.
Oh, well, you use it. I'll drink from the bottle.
Say, Bill.
Yeah?
Tell me, how's business doing here?
Bob, I'm a little worried. That queer contraption over there, is that a lady's hat or a malted milk machine?
Where? Oh, I don't know. I'll see. I wonder what happens if I touch this. Must be one of Hopper. Say, Bill, business ought to pick up in this dress shop since we hired those two new models to show off our dresses. Look, here they are over there. Let's eavesdrop something on them.
Say, Brenda, what is it, Covina?
Isn't it wonderful us getting jobs here as models?
Yeah. Gee, I hope my figure's all right for modeling. Covina, honestly, now, do you think I'm getting middle-aged spread?
Spread? I'd say it was more of a migration.
Covina, turn around. Let me look at you. Oh, you got a shape like Landis.
Carol Landis?
No, Judge.
Oh, yeah, I've got a nice shape. Now, really, don't you think I have an hourglass figure?
Yeah, but it's about 45 minutes late.
Listen, Smarty, you can't talk to me that way. My face has been on many a cover.
Magazine or manhole?
Listen, Brenda, I didn't like that crack. You've been acting awful snooty since the Gophers voted you Miss Buckteeth of 1941.
Oh, you know, last night I dreamed that Clark Gable was chasing me all night. Oh, what a nightmare.
Clark Gable's chasing you, and you call that a nightmare?
Sure, he couldn't catch me.
Say, I was out with a fellow last night who appreciated me. and he admired my figure. Oh, gee, you should have heard the way he admired my figure. And then he popped the question.
He popped the question?
Yeah. But why should I fight Joe Louis?
Oh, let's tend to business, Kobe. Do you like my new garters?
Yeah, I love your new garters. They sure hold your knees up.
I'm laughing. What a smart gag.
Well, what do you expect me to make up on the spur of the moment? After all, I'm not George Bernard Shaw. Well?
Let me see your driver's license.
You pretend like you're working here. Here comes the boss.
Oh, hello, girl.
Oh, hello, Bobsy. We were just modeling some of your new dresses. Don't I look attractive in this dress? Ooh, I bet I'll attract men like flies.
Yes, but you'll attract twice as many flies. Yes, you will. Say, come on, let's get the store in order. I'm expecting Hedda Hopper. I'll call my assistant. Oh, Kelowna.
Coming.
Loose eyeballs. Stop acting foolish, Kelowna. You get under my skin.
Why should I? I've got nothing to hide.
Shh, here comes Hedda now.
Hello, Bob. Nice shop you have here.
Oh, Hedda, this is Brendan Cabina, the only two of their kind in the world.
Really? I thought Adam had four sons.
Well, getting on with the introductions. Professor Kelowna, this is Hedda Hopper.
Come again?
This is Hedda Hopper. Hopper.
Jitterbug, eh?
Be nice to her, Professor. Miss Hopper is syndicated.
Must have been a neat job. The scar doesn't show.
Say, Hedda, tell me, what do you think you can do for Brendan Cabina? They want to attract men. Can you improve their looks?
Well, Bob, looks don't matter so much when it comes to attracting a man. It's the approach that counts. Do you girls approach a man with savoir faire?
No, we sneak up behind him with chloroform.
No, what Hedda means is that when you meet a man, you should play hard to get.
That's right. Now, here comes a man through that doorway. I want you to act with dignity and charm. Now, walk toward him casually. One, two, three, go! See? I beat you again!
Next week, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back at the same time. And with us as our guest will be Lola Lane, the same dang Ann.
Bob Hope.
Thank you, Bill Goodman. Good night, ladies and gentlemen.
This is Bill Goodman speaking for Pepsi. It's the National Broadcasting Company.
From April of 1941, there's the Bob Hope Show with special guest star, columnist Hedda Hopper. In a moment, a very special mystery program starring that great man of the macabre, Vincent Price. As Yesteryear continues.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear. Here's Craig Roberts.
Vincent Price made his radio debut in the early 1940s on network radio and played around a variety of roles up and through the 1950s. He perhaps is best known for his role as always the sinister macabre sort of gentleman in great feature films such as The House of Wax. On this edition of Yesteryear, we have unearthed a very rare recording of Vincent Price starring in a program entitled An Eye for an Eye. We don't know much about the broadcast or even its recording date, though we suspect it stems from the mid-1950s. So without any further ado, let's enjoy a bit of mystery with a man of mystery and macabre himself, Vincent Price, in An Eye for an Eye on Yesteryear.
The Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price. Hello. I know there are those amongst you who will consider the old adage, every picture tells a story, as debatable as it is familiar. As a lifelong art collector and enthusiast myself, I have often speculated that the story surrounding a picture, the human drama, can prove infinitely more fascinating than any story in paint. Trapped within the confines of a frame, and the tale I'm about to tell you which I've called an eye for an eye, will, I'm sure, convince you of the truth of this. Recently, I went to an important sale of Impressionist paintings. The auction room just off London's fashionable St. James was packed to capacity with art speculators from the four corners of the globe.
Lot 23, Auguste Renoir, anemones, oil on canvas 38 inches by 14, an opening bid of 25,000, and 5, 30, 35, bidding at 35 against you, sir, 40, 45, thank you, now standing at 45.
Renoir, Monet, Manet, Degas, each in their turn glowed briefly down at us from the auctioneer's easel, to be knocked down with almost indecent haste and returned backstage for crating and shipping.
Lot 97, Camille.
The auctioneer's voice was tiring now. The serious business of the day was over.
Lot 98, Study of a Girl. Attributed to Pissarro, unsigned, unauthenticated. Oil on canvas, 20 inches by 12, from the estate of the Count Luigi della Santa. Opening bid invited, I think, ladies and gentlemen.
Study of a Girl. And there she was, smiling into the gloom of that near-deserted auction room. My old friend, Luigi della Santa, notorious acquisitor of yachts and palazzos and paintings and celebrities. Now here, this, his last prized acquisition, Study of a Girl. As I consulted the catalog and smiled ruefully that even in death, Luigi steadfastly insisted on his beloved title of Count, it seemed ironically appropriate that the pedigree of his beloved painting should now turn out to be as unauthenticated as his own. But how long ago it all seemed. How long? Midsummer. I'd just completed a long stint of filming in and around Naples. After the sweltering heat of those studio parks, Luigi's invitation to spend a few days with him on his yacht, anchored off of Sorrento, would have been eagerly accepted in any event, but I remembered as the launch ferried me across the mirror smoothness of that beautiful bay that it was the prospect of at last viewing Luigi's recently acquired Pissarro that made the invitation totally irresistible.
Well, Genzo, you like it? Well?
Well, it's beautiful, quite beautiful.
Of course. You see, Contessa, didn't I tell you that my very good and wise friend would come and that he would like it, didn't I?
Yes, Luigi, you did.
And now, Vincenzo, you must tell me how much you like it. $5,000 worth? $10,000?
Luigi, she's exquisite.
Exquisite? Oh, she is perfection. She is the perfection of perfection. She is the perfection of perfection.
You're spilling your wine, Caro.
And yet, would you believe it, when I tell you, my friend, there are still those dilettantes, those ingrates, those whoremongers who have the gall to insult the intelligence by saying that it cannot be the work of the master.
Oh, but Luigi, the master did not think fit to sign it.
What need for him to sign it when every line makes a signature? I tell you, this is not a painting. It is an experience. She is alive, vibrant.
Oh, such passionate enthusiasm, Luigi. I shall begin to suspect I have acquired a rival. Vincenzo, if you will permit. It is not the wine of my country, but then it is not the wine of my choosing. Mm. The Count prefers to import. So instead of buona fortuna, permit me to wish you bonne chance.
Bonne chance. As she proposed the toast, the charms of Luigi's Contessa di Terra made those of the artist model obvious, commonplace, and it was almost as though the Contessa were reading my thoughts.
But I feel sure you will forgive dear Luigi's schoolboy enthusiasm for this new acquisition, Vincenzo. As a lifelong friend, you will doubtless have witnessed many such enthusiasms.
It isn't difficult to forgive. I so wholeheartedly share it.
Ah, bravo, my friend.
Perhaps. But between you and Luigi, the appreciation has always been different, I think.
Oh? How different?
Be warned, Vincenzo. It is not wise to encourage her.
Because watching you see the painting for the very first time, there was peace. It was not hard to tell that for you, the appreciation was for the talent it contained, for the genius. You understood what had been intended and what had been achieved.
And for me? Is it not the same for me?
Prego, Luigi, permit me to finish. You see, Vincenzo, before Luigi permits me the time to make a point, he is so perfectly demonstrating it. It is not what the painting does inside of him that makes him so determined to possess it. It is simply because there are others who might wish to possess it even more than he does. The price is all that is important for him. He asks how much you think it is worth. $5,000? $10,000? And when you refuse to give him the answer...
Am unable to.
See how prettily he sulks. Oh, it's not his fault, you understand. It does not make me love him less, but everything in this so beautiful life is reduced to the level of price, status, possession. Everything which is bad enough, but everyone worse.
Oh.
Much worse. But possession, life, cannot always be that simple. People, things, cannot always be caught in the net of our understanding. Just as it is not always possible to divorce the manner of our deaths from the manner of our lives.
Ah, tante dante. Much talk makes for much hunger.
scusa, Count. La colazione è servito.
Sì, Carlos, sì. Come, my friends, we are to take luncheon on the deck. Besides, after so much play-acting in the dark, Vincenzo, it is now necessary we turn the color to your cheeks.
Well, it's nothing I'd like better.
Also, most important, Luigi has yet another treat in store for you.
Another?
Sì. To mark the private viewing of his so beautiful painting, the great Luigi, master chef of all the Italias, has himself created a unique gastronomic masterpiece. A meal worthy of a gourmet of such international repute as you.
Oh, my dear Luigi, such flattery. At this rate, the color will be returned to my cheeks much sooner than you anticipate.
We shall see, Vincenzo. We shall see.
Contessa?
We shall see.
Our lunch party looked like being a jolly affair, to begin with, anyway. The wine and the sun went straight to our heads, and the Contessa's affectionate baiting of Luigi continued good-humoredly as the first course was served. The question of Luigi's title provided her readiest target of attack. As to his true origins, well, there were many who insisted that his father could still be found running a small trattoria in that straggling, impoverished town we now viewed across the bay.
So why doesn't he admit it? Be proud to admit it. You see, it is always so. What he refuses to accept, he laughs away. Is that not so, Vincenzo?
I think I'll just concentrate on this excellent wine.
Oh, but you disappoint me. What? You tell me that you, too, are afraid to burst this ridiculous balloon.
Perhaps because Vincenzo has the good sense to realize it is not a balloon. And that it certainly is not ridiculous. It is...
What is it, Bambino? What is it?
It is an insult. It is a double insult of my lineage and breeding.
I'm sorry, Luigi.
Oh, so don't be my friend. It's good to laugh at such archaic distinctions.
Vincenzo has seen the papers. Is that not true?
I have seen papers.
Papers are for the forging. So, has Vincenzo seen my papers? Of course he has not. And why has he not? Because he does not need to. He has only to use his eyes to realize that I am of the line... just as you are, of the gutter.
Then why does the Contessa dishonor her line by sitting at my table?
Oh, because even a penniless Contessa has to eat somewhere. And like his cook of a father, and his cook of a grandfather before him, Count Luigi still makes the best fish soup in the whole of Italy. True, Caro?
True, my father and his father before him made the best soup in...
Caught, Caro. Uh-huh.
The Contessa's high praise for Luigi's culinary skills were justified, certainly, whether inherited or not. After a lifetime of experience, I've come to the conclusion that there are only really two kinds of master chef. Those who have spent long years perfecting their skills, and those who have added to this a simple flair, an ability to transform the simplest meal into something near approaching a work of art.
But now, my good friends, your attention, your undivided attention, if you please. It is with the greatest pride and pleasure Luigi himself presents to you his own original creation.
Oh!
Specialité of the house. Vincenzo.
Luigi waited. As I peered into the deep serving tureen he set in front of me, I remember thinking that after the great build-up he'd given it, his specialty of the house turned out to be something of an anti-climax. The ingredients were certainly commonplace enough, served on a bed of rice, a veritable hodgepodge of, well, of all the kinds of fish native to the locality, something I'd frequently enjoyed with a bottle of ordinary vino at any harborside trattoria.
So, you like it? But now, why don't you look even closer, my friend?
He was waiting again. So, simply to oblige him, I did look closer, and then I saw it. A large octopus sat squarely upon its bed of lobster pieces and king-sized prawns. To my best recollection, I'd never seen one cooked whole before. So perhaps this was the special touch my Italian friend had in mind. And then it happened. The creature's great saucer eyes opened and gazed balefully into mine. My God, it was alive.
Now he sees. So, how do you like my little beauty?
I'm not sure.
But I have created a new delicacy.
A live delicacy?
Alive, Vincenzo.
Between us, we will set a new gastronomic trend, you see. Oh, purists like the Contessa may at first condemn it. A return to marine cannibalism, perhaps, eh? But I tell you, Vincenzo, and you will agree for yourself, that in the gastronomic stakes, a live lobster boat screaming to the boil will prove strictly for the peasant. Now, please. Well, taste it.
I'm sorry. At first I just thought it was some kind of a joke.
A joke?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm still not sure if you... But it isn't, is it?
No.
I'm sorry, Luigi.
You object?
Well, simply, let's say, decline.
But why...
I can't explain.
Try. For Luigi's sake, why don't you try?
Well, even for Luigi's sake... Well, I'm just not sure I can. It's something to do with the very aliveness of the thing, of course, but more than that, it's the eyes. A sort of watchfulness in the eyes.
You disappoint me, my friend. You know that? You disappoint me.
I'm sorry.
You object. But you cannot even begin to explain why you object.
Luigi, please. Vincenzo is your guest.
For which I am sorry. Because not only does he show a singular lack of adventure, but because he stupidly finds the dish somehow objectionable on humanitarian grounds. True or not
true?
But why? The oysters you love, are they not live? A well-known scientific fact. All sea creatures are impervious to pain. Any 10-year-old angler will tell you, my friend, they have no brain, no mind, no nervous system, let alone this so-called finer feelings which you and the Contessa would seem to attribute to them. Apart from which, the pathetic specimen you see before you is itself possessed of those same cannibal instincts which you now accuse me of possessing.
I accuse you of nothing, Luigi.
Hourly sucking into the disgusting chasm of its stomach a million tiny sea creatures. To first digest, and then spew out the remains which are neither palatable or necessary to its uniquely selfish existence.
Except that you have overlooked one thing, Luigi.
Huh?
We have no way of knowing. In spite of the sworn word of any 10-year-old angler, we have no way of really knowing whether the creature we see squirming in front of us is capable of feeling or not.
Knowing, my dear Contessa, what is there to know?
Everything. Anything. Simply because, perhaps, it chooses to reveal nothing. We shall never know. Not unless it were possible for one of us to take its place. At this very moment, to be on the receiving end.
Permit me to produce the evidence.
With a single deft circular movement of his knife, Luigi removed one of those enormous eyes. The creature attempted vaguely to scale the deep sides of the dish, but at last, realizing there could be no escape, floundered back, stonily regarding Luigi with its one remaining eye. The mucus from its socket mingled now with the rich Madeira of the sauce that had replaced its natural element. Luigi regarded it dispassionately, then flicked the eye on the heavy silver of his embossed plate. That evening, over after-dinner brandies, my squeamishness turned to embarrassment. An apology seemed in order, and I was happy to provide it.
But, my dear Vincenzo, there is nothing to be forgiven. Unless it is the weather. More brandy.
Oh, thank you.
I had planned on taking the launch to show you a few of the night spots across the bay, but I'm afraid until the storm decides to blow itself out...
Think no more of it. I'm really perfectly happy.
Which is a good deal more than can be said for the Contessa, I think. Isn't that so, Caro?
Oh, if you say so, Luigi, then I suppose it must be.
But you've hardly said a word since lunch.
Haven't I?
You know you haven't.
Oh, then I can only blame the storm. Unless it is that it's late and I'm tired. I really would like to retire for the night.
Oh, but of course.
So soon, Contessa. The night is young.
No, dear Luigi. The night is never young. It is the same age at its birth as at its death. It is we who must inhabit the bright lights of day. We grow old. As old as we are allowed to grow. Good night.
Good night, Contessa.
A cigar, perhaps.
Hmm? Oh, I'm sorry, Luigi. I wasn't...
Now you're doing it again, my friend. Apologizing for one thing and overreacting for another.
Am I?
Yes, you're overreacting to my Contessa. But then you have been all day.
Well, then I certainly didn't intend to.
But found it impossible not to.
Well, it is late, Luigi.
You see, my friend, the effect she has on us is infectious.
Oh, please. I only meant it's been rather a long day. But if you'd rather...
No, I insist. Whatever our mysterious lady claims to the contrary, tomorrow is another day. We shall welcome it together.
Well, good night, Luigi. By the way, it's macabre of me, I know. But what did happen?
You want to,
to
know what happened to our one-eyed sea monster?
Yes.
Thrown overboard with the rest of the garbage? Oh, not out of any finer sense of returning it to its own. I do assure you, its remains will attract the other sea creatures. The cycle of cannibalism perpetuates itself. Besides, it makes for excellent fishing. If you promise to get up before noon, I'll get one of the crew to fix us up with a couple of lines.
Good night. lay in my cabin listening to the storm, it was strange how deeply Luigi's mood of the evening had disturbed me. The extrovert, arrogant Luigi. And then it had been a long day, so sleep now. Gently, gratefully, into sleep. Sleep. Sleep.
Isabella? Isabella, mon amore. Is that you?
Isabella, don't tease me.
No, please don't, Isabella.
Oh, my God. No. No. Oh!
It was the steward, Carlos, who found him. But having seen what he had seen, he would not again venture into the cabin. Straddled grotesquely across the bed, in a splatter of torn flesh and blood, was the thing that had been Luigi. There were the marks of giant tentacles about the dull, snapped head. The tongue rolled gigantic from between those swollen purple lips. But overall, there was the unmistakable evidence that the whole head had been somehow inexplicably pulped outwards, as though it had first been sucked in under some enormous, unnatural pressure, fed upon, and the remains spewed out again onto the fine linen of those monogrammed pillows. But not all spewed back. Not all totally discarded. For when I could bring myself to look at the thing again, there was no mistaking the fact. Only one of Luigi's eyes stared back at me. The other socket lay seeping. Empty. The Contessa was standing at my side.
How do we know they have no feeling? How do we know they are not capable of understanding and of revolt? And if revolt, why not revenge? A revenge to be fearfully enacted by others of their own kind. Larger, stronger, more terrifying than anything we dare imagine. There is no evidence such monsters do exist. But is there any proof that they do not?
I looked away from that single cyclops eye, and leading from what remained a trail of slime, much like the slime of some enormous slug. I followed its course. It climbed the French brocade wallpaper, shattered the high chromium finish of the porthole, crossed the deep teak polish of the deck beyond, and from thence it slimed down the hull. The spume of it still floated out there, oil-like, on the calm waters of that beautiful Italian bay. Then it descended eternally into the dark depths that lay beneath.
That was Vincent Price bringing you The Price of Fear with Roger Snowden, Anne Jemison, and Christopher Bidmead. An Eye for an Eye was first recounted and dramatized by William Ingram and produced by John Dias. Hello.
from the 1950s is Vincent Price starring in An Eye for an Eye. And that'll just about draw us to a close on this rendition of Yesteryear. Thanks so much for being with us, and make it a point to tell a friend to also tune in and enjoy every week at this time the best of the golden age of radio right here on Yesteryear. Till next time, I'm Craig Roberts. So long.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. Comedy, mystery, fireside chat. Together we sat listening nightly to our favorite show.